Welcome to the Got Your Six podcast. This podcast brings together current service members and veteran high performers to share their methods, strategies, and ideas delivered in an informative and, most importantly, actionable way that'll help you lead yourself and those around you from the battlefield to the boardroom. Coming to you every episode, I'm your host, Tony Nash, and into the breach.
Nothing mentioned on this podcast is an endorsement or opinion of the Department of Defense.
I got your six, we got your back. Got your six, we got your back. Got your six, we got your back. I got your six.
Sixers, what an unbelievable treat we have today. I thought long and hard about how to do the opening intro for our guests. And we could go about accolades, different titles that he's held. But what I find interesting is that he's the only active duty service member to throw out the opening pitch and do the coin flip at the Super Bowl. General Dave, retired Petraeus, thank you so much for being on the Got Your Six podcast.
Great to be with you. Thanks. I'll tell you, throwing out a pitch in a World Series game, that's pressure.
I was going to say, so what was that like?
You can't throw it in the dirt. We train for that. You have to train. So I was in Washington at the time. The game was going to be down in Tampa, actually, St. Petersburg, where the Tampa Bay Rays play, indoor stadium. So lots of noise in it when they come on their feet. But we opened up the Washington Nationals field. They accommodated us, and I got to pitch off the mound because I was determined not to pitch from, the grass or something. You got to pitch from the mound. I was in my Class A uniform. I thought I should do that, with decorations and so forth. Because all the behind you are going to be all these soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and their Class A holding the flags of the 50 states. But you have a different throwing motion because you can't bend your elbow quite the way you can with, the old green Army uniform. So I had to make sure I could throw with that kind of motion. I was a pitcher back in my youth, and so it came back reasonably quickly. But I'll tell you, my heart was moving a bit when I went to the mound, held the ball up, turned around, and the entire audience came to their feet to do that pitch. It was wonderful.
That's awesome. And then do you think like the boys back home in Cornwall were like, look at Peaches out there throwing out the opening pitch?
Yeah, this has all been astonishing to them from very early on.
Well, and that's interesting too, because you grew up pretty much more or less like in the shadow of West Point, but it wasn't always something you wanted to do. I know your father was a merchant marine captain. Your mom is a librarian. And then kind of getting to that point, I think maybe your dad wanted you to go to Annapolis. Is that right?
Yeah, I think we'd spent a lot of time in the water together. I had my own sailboat at, the age of 12 or 13 or something like that. We had the family sailboat. And obviously, he had a passion for the sea. He was Dutch. He went to the Dutch Merchant Marine Academy equivalent. It was at sea during World War II when the Nazis overran Holland. They couldn't go home. So they went to the Brooklyn Navy Yard, signed on with the U.S. Merchant Marine, had a very long war for them, that had the highest per capita loss rate, actually, because of the way the U-boats and battleships were sinking the merchant fleet in particular, because they didn't have much self-defense. He survived a Murmansk run in which nearly half of the convoy was sunk. So he had a lot of passion for sailing, for the ocean, and all the rest of that, even though he had actually retired at a point around where I showed up on the scene. And so I think he much would have preferred that I go there. But again, growing up 7 miles from West Point, half of my newspaper route customers were either West Point graduates or serving West Point officers or on the staff and faculty at West Point. And, we do a lot, I think, in life because we want to be like Mike, like someone we admire. And, I admired West Point cadets and wanted to be like them. And so it was a little bit natural, I think, at that point in time. Even our high school soccer coach had actually coached the West Point team when he was a commissioned officer, actually, I think during the war years, to the national championship. And then he was retired colonel, and Cornwall just wanted to do something. So for $1 a year, he coached the high school soccer team, and we won the championship our senior year.
And that's not your first run-in with someone in your life that's really kind of gone on. When you were in the 101st, if I remember correctly, you took a bullet literally to the chest.
Through the chest.
Yeah. Left or right, you wouldn't be here today. But your surgeon was Bill First, who ended up being the senior majority leader later on in life.
Yeah, it was very helpful, actually. Obviously, we didn't know that at the time. And right. Later, I used to jokingly say that I was dying to meet Bill First. But it was wonderful because, first of all, he was from Tennessee, Fort Campbell, Kentucky. As you know, you're serving there is actually more in Tennessee than it is in Kentucky. But because it has a ties to two states, So we had Senator McConnell, now the minority leader, who was in Kentucky, and you had Senator Frist, who was the at that time was the majority leader from Tennessee. And it was actually quite helpful because early on in Iraq, after the invasion and after we were air assaulted up to Mosul and had things going quite well, we really needed some supplemental funding to solidify the gains in security that we had achieved by showing the Iraqi citizens that their life would be better if they supported us and their new government than supporting the insurgents who were trying to make life difficult for us in the new government. And the way you did that was by carrying out a variety of different sort of infrastructure projects, training host nation security forces, stimulating economic growth, repairing damage done through the fighting and all the rest of this. And Senator Frist came out. He made a point to visit us. He asked what I needed. And I said, you know, we need money. Money's ammunition at this point in time. So is ammunition, by the way, if you're in a real fight. You don't throw dollars at them. But that's what we need. And that brought about the Commander's Emergency Reconstruction Program that turned out to be so important for us during those the height of those war years.
Yeah, and that was incredibly vital.
Yes.
Because you're dealing with invisible infrastructure at that point, not like, but you're trying to build this network of people and connective nodes to essentially sway everybody away from the insurgency.
Plenty of physical infrastructure too.
Absolutely.
And we had to repair these roads that had been completely damaged, the bridges that had been dropped, the airfields that had been cratered, the schools that had been damaged, the restore the medical. You know, again, it was comprehensive. We ended up doing, I think it was literally 5,500 small projects during the course of our time in Mosul during that first year in Iraq, and it really paid off. We had a very good situation there for much, much longer than did other units throughout Iraq. There were a number of other reasons for that as well. We were the only ones allowed to carry out a reconciliation process with the former Baathists, a terrible decision to, first of all, fire the military without telling them what their future was, which created hundreds of thousands of Iraqi men who were trained, and most of them had taken their weapons home with them when the forces collapsed in the end. And now their only incentive was to oppose the new Iraq rather than to support it. And then the second decision to conduct de-Baathification, in other words, to throw everyone who had been part of Saddam's party out of government employment, which is the only employment in a country like that, that kind of economy, even though many of them were at a very low level. And they were basically bureaucrats. I mean, there were 110 tenured professors in Mosul University, a university of nearly 30,000 students that were trying to rebuild and repair because it had been suffered terrible damage from the war and then subsequent looting. But again, now we've just lost the 110 top people who had gone to Western universities and were quite secular. And we really needed them. And so we had the opportunity. We were given, I was given the opportunity by the Coalition Provisional Authority Ambassador Bremer to do a test of reconciliation, which we did with probably somewhere between 8 and 10,000 citizens, which was very, very significant. And it kept the peace there much longer than in anywhere else in Iraq.
Well, and you've talked about this as a strategic leader, is like understanding and making sure you're attacking first the right big idea, because there's a lot of things going on, especially in that complex environment. In your four-step process, right? Understanding the right idea, communicating, overseeing and refining it. Where do you think people kind of struggle, especially at the strategic level in that?
Oh, it's first and foremost. Again, you got to get the big ideas right. So the tasks of a strategic leader in particular, but it's all other leaders as well. It's just that the other leaders are conducting the first task of getting the big ideas right, the strategy, within the constraints established by the strategic leader, who is getting the overarching strategy and big ideas right, hopefully. By the way, if you don't get them right, everything else builds on it. Doesn't matter how inspirational, energetic, determined, motivational, and skilled a leader you are, if you don't get the big ideas right, you're building on a shaky foundation with all else that you do. So first and foremost, you've got to get the big ideas right. Second, you have to communicate them effectively throughout the breadth and depth of the organization and to all the others that should be concerned about that, stakeholders and host nation and coalition countries and everything else, to take the case of, say, the surge in Iraq. Then you have to oversee the implementation of the big ideas. This is your example, your energy, your determination, your how you spend your time, your battle rhythm, the metrics, the hiring, the firing, the incentivizing, the all of that. And then you have to formally sit down and determine how you need to refine the big idea so you're a learning organization and learn faster than your adversary so you can do it again and again and again. But getting the big ideas right is crucial. And frankly, we didn't have the big ideas right at some critical junctures, including when we began the surge. We had to reverse the big ideas by 180 degrees. We had been pulling our forces out of the population areas, out of the neighborhoods, consolidating on big bases, handing off to the Iraqis, and the violence had gotten worse and worse and worse throughout 2006 for a variety of different reasons, including most significantly the bombing of a sacred Shia shrine in a Sunni majority area in Samarra. And it was a horrible event. And it set off a cycle of violence that needed to be halted and then reversed. But you couldn't do it, depending on the Iraqi security forces, which have been degraded so significantly by that violence. So we had to go back into the, I mean, this is, again, people talk about change management. It doesn't get any more substantial than 180 degrees. Back into the neighborhoods, just, it was 77 locations just in Baghdad. And you had to fight for most of those to establish them, secure them, then get gated communities, as we termed it, so you can control the population access to it, really, so you can keep the insurgents out. Once you clear it, you hold it by, again, controlling access to these areas and gradually then rebuilding them, then reconstituting our host nation security force partners, the Iraqi army, the Iraqi police, and others. So this is a massive shift. And again, when it comes to big idea changes, as I said, it doesn't get any more significant than that.
And coming up with the big ideas, though, and being in an organization, sometimes you're going to hear from people that are kind of out there or pushing against the grain, right? How do you protect, or how have you protected, the iconoclasts?
Well, you engage with them. You want them part of the process. Again, when you're developing the big ideas or refining them, you want everybody to be part of the process. You want everybody to be inside the tent, if you will, metaphorically speaking, because you know what they do if they're outside the tent to those who are inside. And so you want to have an open, transparent, inclusive, and generally iterative process. I've never been one who, you know, sits under the right tree and gets hit on the head by Newton's apple fully formed. You do have moments where, but it's not the fully formed. You get hit on the head, at least I do, by the seed of a big idea, and you then have to shape it like a clay object. And the shaping process is by having everyone help you with that. Again, in this iterative process, noting that no one of us is smarter than all of us together, and you need to operationalize that. So again, you want to preserve and protect the iconoclasts because occasionally they're right and they're challenging you, and they're not going to leave something left unsaid. This is part of building a culture. This is part of task number three, overseeing the implementation. Part of that is, what kind of culture do you want to build? And it should be a culture of openness, and a culture that welcomes reasoned, thoughtful, and constructive dissent to the point that you make the decision, at which point in time everybody needs to embrace it and you need to start the execution. So again, that first step is crucial. But then, of course, you do have to persuade people. You have to publish your counterinsurgency guidance. You have to iterate that. You have to emphasize it. And then you have to, again, oversee the implementation, drive the campaign plan. Again, all these different tasks that are associated, that's what we normally think of as leadership, by the way. It's those particular tasks. And we tend to skirt over the big ideas, which are crucial. You've got to get those right. By the way, you do this at subordinate levels. When I was a battalion commander, in fact, in the brigade where you are in the 101st Airborne Division, 3rd Brigade, the Rakasans, commanding the Iron Rakasan Battalion, you know, we had five areas of focus, emphasis, and we built these out. We operationalized the daylights out of these. And I think if you talk to the old Iron Rakasans from 91 to 93, when I was privileged to be the commander, most of them will get at least four of those, and not all five. And they'll groan when they do it because, you know, oh God, you know, again, you drive that. Repetition is part of the whole process. But then determining, how do you refine them? How do you, the implementation, refine the big ideas and do it all again and again and again. That's part of this particular intellectual construct for the conduct of leadership. But at the strategic level, when you're at the very top, when you're commanding the surge in Iraq or the surge in Afghanistan or leading the CIA or something like that, it's all about getting those big ideas right. And again, you can have all the other great qualities, but if you don't get those right, those are for naught.
Right. And it's those seeds that you're taking, like you said, along the way as you shape the big ideas, because your counterinsurgency guidance was really just a collaboration or curation of different ideas along the way.
It was a series of admonitions. And each one of those said to do something, you know, so it was, it's the biggest of the big ideas captures the recognition that we have to live with the people to secure them. You can't commute to the fight. You can't consolidate on a big base, drive through the neighborhood a couple of times and leave it in the night to the insurgents. You have to live there to secure them. And we're going to take back the responsibility from the Iraqi security forces. So the very first one was secure and serve the people. And then you'd explain what that meant, you know, to secure the people, we must live with them, et cetera, et cetera. There was one I particularly enjoyed, which was promote initiative. In the absence of orders, figure out what they should have been and execute aggressively. And that came actually from a sign on a company commander's door, you know, this plywood little command post that he had over in West Rashid in southwest Baghdad, out of the Big Red One, a really talented young company commander, then now a brigade commander in the 10th Mountain Division, I might add. So again, you find these, and you know, I was always updating. I had it open always on my laptop, because if I saw something during the course of a day, I would update it. And then about once a month, every say 30 to 45 days, I'd hit the send key and said, here's the latest iteration. Everybody gets it. Everybody should operationalize it at his or her level. That's the way. And by the way, again, we did lots of events, or maybe even tactics, techniques, and procedures to constantly provide feedback for me, twice a week, a minimum. And I was adamant about this. We would go out and go on patrol with a unit. So right after the 7:30 to 8:30 morning update, we'd get in an armored vehicle or in a helicopter and a plane if we were going north or south. And then we'd link up with a battalion. They'd give a quick Humvee briefing, not PowerPoint to death in a conference room, and then immediately go out on patrol in an area where you can engage with the population, engage with host nation security force partners, talk to platoon leaders, company commanders, obviously the battalion commander. And then after all of that, we would structure it in a way so the final event would always be a meeting with just the company commanders, with no one else in the room, including the battalion commander. And I would say, look, you are the individuals who are the last level of command that actually know every person in your formation by face, not just by name or number. You owe it to them to tell me if there's something that we have not done adequately for you. And every one of you is going to have to give me a sustain and then an improve. And you go around the room and then around the other way, and you can't say me too. So you would, and again, there only might be five company commanders in that tent or whatever, but you'd hear from them really unfiltered what they were concerned about, what we weren't doing adequately to support them. And that's the level at which you win or lose the kind of irregular warfare in which we were engaged. And I'd take those back and, you know, we'd go to work on those. I also gave them my email address. And I said, if there's a moment down the road where you're just frustrated with your chain of command, email me directly. I'll try to hide you, if you will, to protect you. But I need to know if a company commander in this multinational force is not satisfied with those above you are doing. And I got, over time, as that gets out to more and more and more, I would get several emails a week and we'd go to work on those. So that's all part of that process of building the culture, getting unfiltered input, showing that you really want to hear what they have to say. That's pretty important.
And that goes back to your point, and we kind of talked about this too, of you being an absolute competitor across the board, right? Whether it was push-up competitions, being the fastest in the division as the division commander or one of the fastest, you're constantly looking at repetition.
Yeah, I'm afraid when I was Eagle 6, I was pushing 50 at that point in time, and I could still, I think I ran the Army 10 miler in 63:50 or something like that, which was okay, but it was the slowest I think I'd ever done. But I mean, we worked hard for that. It was just before we deployed, as a matter of fact. And But yeah, no, we had the Iron Eagle competition when I was a Rockeson. That's where the very first one began. That was the Iron Rockeson competition in the 82nd Airborne Division. We had the Iron Devil competition. We even had the Iron Student competition at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, when I was the commander there. And we had the staff college and all the, you know, 1,000 competitive majors. But look, life is a competitive endeavor. And I think you have to embrace that reality. And you have to try to be the very best that you can be at every aspect of your job. And if you're particularly, if you're in a light infantry organization, such as the 101st or the 82nd, one air assault, the other airborne, at a certain point in time, you know, you're in your leather personnel carriers under a rucksack and you need to be seriously fit. And physical fitness was one of those top five, as I mentioned earlier. As a battalion commander, and we were very serious about it. I mean, we did PT for an hour and a half every morning. We locked the barracks. We owned our own mess hall then still, which was a real advantage. We moved the chow hours later. We could not, you didn't go to the gym because people do weight watching, not weight lifting. They don't really understand their way. And they want to go in there when it's cold and wet. And if you're infantry, you know, cold and wet, soldier is an outdoor sport. So again, we really operationalized this, and I was quite draconian about this. I certified every platoon sergeant, platoon leader, company commander, and first sergeant for the conduct of physical training. And if they, you know, didn't do it right, they were decertified. And we only had to do that once or twice, and people took very seriously, you know what, this guy actually means what he's written in describing how we're going to operationalize serious physical fitness. By the way, we then also won cross-country championship every year. We won the football championship. We won softball, I think, once or twice. We, you know, were finalists in all these. But again, it comes down to results as well. As my dad used to say periodically, results boy. And so, you know, you can talk a good game, but you actually got to play a good game as well. But again, life is a competitive endeavor and you got to compete. By the way, you do compete not just to be the best individually, but the best team player as well. And that was very important. And when we had, for example, we had our own pre-ranger course as a battalion, think about that. And it was phenomenal. So we had more enlisted rangers in the 2 years that I was there than any other brigade in the 101st Airborne Division. And actually, I think any other brigade outside of the Ranger Regiment or any other battalion outside the Ranger Regiment. So we had 3 times the number of enlisted and non-commissioned officer graduates during that 2 year period. It's because we had but then, you know, the brigade commander said, hey, Roxanne Six said, you know, how about running for the whole brigade? You bet. Sure. You know, give me some additional instructors from the other battalions and we'll be happy to do, you know, be your executive agent and we'll help the whole organization lift up. And eventually, actually, then I became the division G3 and we made it for the whole division. But again, as I said, you got to compete to be the best team. But when I was Eagle Six, the commander of the 101st Airborne Division during the fight to Baghdad, we realized that, yeah, we'd love to have, you know, our next rendezvous with destiny be to air assault onto Baghdad International Airport. But you know what we really needed to do? We needed to support the 3rd Infantry Division, which was most well trained and equipped for the war we were in, which was a mechanized armored combat. And so we put our Apaches in front of them, 72 of them, night after night after night. And then during the days, when they asked for, you know, you got any 155 millimeter howitzer ammunition, I said, take the entire, it was only a battery, but take the whole unit uploaded because that's the quickest way to get it to you. In fact, he asked, I said, what else do you need? He said, do you have an infantry battalion? I gave him 3rd of the 187, the unit I commanded. We air assaulted them right on the Baghdad International Airport where they needed them to withstand what turned out to be a pretty significant counterattack that night. So again, you've got to do the best you can, not only as an individual and in your individual unit, but to support the greater good.
And that goes back to, because that training, knowing when to kind of push forward and when you got to look to support the team, right? Because you're going to be dealing, I think it was Churchill that talked about dealing with like the black dog days, those like really hard, challenging times that come, whether they're personally, professionally, or as an organization. You have to be able to have that camaraderie and understanding to push through whatever that adversity is.
Well, you have to have it individually as well. I mean, again, leaders of organizations, particularly in combat organizations, have hard days, very tough casualties, setbacks, shortcomings, mistakes, all the rest of this. And you've got to be able to deal with that You've got to be sufficiently resilient. This comes of a degree of physical fitness, mental toughness, all of which is developed along the way. You know, why do you do 25-mile road marches? Mental toughness. Yeah, there's a physical component to that, certainly, especially, again, if you're in a light infantry unit. But at the end of the day, there's an awful lot about just sheer mental toughness. And you have to structure that. You have to develop it. There's a muscle there that has to be built and kept sturdy and strong as well. So, yeah, you have to do that. And, you know, then, by the way, Churchill had that other great comment about coalition warfare and having been privileged to lead two very large coalitions in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think Afghanistan, the largest ever fighting coalition, 50 or more countries. He said the only thing worse than fighting with allies is fighting without them. And he was very true. I mean, it takes a lot of coalition management is a lot like ego management. You know, when you work with certain elements of our military that have very substantial egos.
Sir, to go back to when you talked about individual, like mental toughness, is there a point in your life where you got to like probably your lowest and you've been able to kind of work your way back? And what did that look like for you to be able to continue to push through that mental toughness? And maybe it was pulling in allies and people, whether it was at coalition scale or like just individuals. Can you kind of talk us through like what you did personally?
No, I think, again, I mean, it just as a general statement, life is not all high five moments. It's not all spike in the football in the end zone. You got to be really measured in how you do that. You should act like you've been there before. As I think it was Walter Payton's father used to counsel his son. There are setbacks. There are shortcomings. There are individual mistakes that you make. There are mistakes that your unit makes. I remember one very substantial one where a soldier during the surge in Iraq decided to use pages of the Quran for target practice on a 25-meter range to zero his M4 carbine. And tragically, a host nation worker found this. Of course, it immediately goes to the prime minister, and I end up apologizing on camera to the prime minister. President Bush calls him personally to apologize. I mean, this is a massive blow to the overall effort. And again, there's tons of these. And when they happen, whether a result of your own mistakes or those within the organization, or just again, as I said, very tough days, you've got to have the resilience to recognize that, you know, get back on your feet, get the organization back on its feet, metaphorically speaking, dust yourself off, pick your rucksack up, and start putting one foot in front of the other. I always drew strength from the description of Grant at Shiloh. I happened to be reading Bruce Catton's book, Grant Takes Command, during the time that I was the commander of the surge in the early months. I was really surprised. Somebody gave me the book right before I left Fort Leavenworth with a beautiful inscription from the head of the military studies and history group that is out at Fort Leavenworth, Combat Studies Institute, it's called. And it ended up in a rucksack and it ends up over there. It's on a table by my bunk in Baghdad. And I started leafing through it and I found it positively inspirational. I mean, I'd only get maybe two or three pages each night before it'd fall out of my hand and I'd fall asleep, but because we were right at the edge of what we could physically do. And of course, there were no weekends, so you didn't recharge yourself. So you had to be careful about that. But I remember reading about Shiloh, which is his worst battle ever. And he's almost driven back into the Tennessee River. His most trusted subordinate, Sherman, is there with him. He got surprised on the battlefield. They ultimately prevail. They own the battlefield. The Confederates withdraw. The commander is killed. But it's a very, very painful battle, and they take very high casualties. But at the end of that first day, they're on the bank of the Tennessee. Grant's trying hard to get additional soldiers and reinforcements and units in through boats. He's standing under a tree. Light drizzle. He's got his slouch hat on, stub of a cigar in his mouth. There's cries of those who are having their limbs amputated. Every available shelter is being used as a makeshift hospital. There's the mourn of the battlefield, if you will, those who are still out there needing to be recovered. And Sherman comes out of the dark and says, "Well, Grant, we had the devil's own day today, didn't we?" And Grant says, "Yep, lick him tomorrow, though." And that sheer indomitable will is what he possessed, and it's what any commander has to possess. And I was hugely inspired by his example during the Civil War, not trying in the least to equate the war in Iraq to the Civil War in the United States, but But again, there is relevance to the individual who's at the top of such an endeavor, as he ultimately was, and becomes the man who saves the Union by crafting the strategy that ultimately enables the Union to prevail, because Lincoln gets reelected because of the victories in Atlanta and in the Valley. It didn't have to be that way. It could have been that McClellan would have defeated Lincoln in November 1864, and he would have sued for peace, and the Union, as we know it, would have ceased to exist. So again, that example, and he repeatedly got the big ideas right, communicate. He was a brilliant communicator in a day in which commanders wrote their own orders. He could see, he could envision a battlefield in space and time as it unfolded and give orders to the units so that it essentially described to them what they needed to do as their part of this overall effort in space and time. And then he would oversee it, a tremendous example, imperturbable, courageous, great horseman as well, and then determine how to refine it and do it again and again and again. So he was really a great strategic leader. In fact, he's really the only U.S. Army commander to be brilliant in combat at the tactical level, that's the land between the lakes battles that are near Fort Campbell, in fact. Then, in particular, at the operational level, Vicksburg, but also the Battle Above the Clouds and so forth, Chattanooga. And then at the strategic level, when he's the commander of all Union forces and designs, for the first time, a true comprehensive strategy for the war, and ultimately oversees the implementation of it to success. There is no one else, actually, in the U.S. Army's history who has done that, actually. There are individuals that did brilliantly at one level or the other, but never all three. And part of it, of course, you just don't have wars that are long enough for people to be tactical, operational, and strategic.
I think that the really driving force there is he was always had some sort of action forcing mechanism, right, to kind of update his intellectual capital to go forward. How do you continue to become more or less better than yesterday, sir, at this point, at this juncture?
Well, I think you structure that. I mean, you have to create that for yourself. You have to set goals and objectives that are going to cause you to do that. I mean, when I went to graduate school, for example, it was to get a master's degree in advance of teaching at West Point. And I went in and said, look, I know I only have 2 years, and normally it takes 2 years for a master's, but what I want to do simultaneously is all the coursework for the PhD, the language exam, the general exams for the PhD, the dissertation prospectus, et cetera. And they said, you know, you just can't be done. No one's done that. So I got the rule book out and figured out how to do that. It turned what would have been a wonderful experience into a miserable 2 years, but it was really, really worth doing. So you do that. You force yourself. You know, you say, I'm going to run a marathon and I'm going to break 3 hours or 250 or what have you. And, you know, you curse yourself for that. Why did I ever do this while you're training for it? But, you know, again, when you go through the tape and, you know, it's, I think my fastest was 250-50, but, you know, you feel pretty good about that. But you wouldn't have done that if you didn't, in a sense, create that action forcing mechanism for yourself. And, you know, I teach now, it's at Yale, but I've held 4 or 5 different teaching positions over the years at different great universities. And again, often done the different path rather than the normal path because it gets you out of your intellectual comfort zone as well. That was going to civilian graduate school, a huge decision, actually. I was told that I was committing professional suicide when I did that instead of going to the Ranger Regiment. You know, it turned out okay. But I didn't do the war college. I did a fellowship, and then I didn't even finish the fellowship. I deployed to Haiti to be the chief of operations for the United Nations force there. Phenomenally developing experience, a coalition effort, and just purely a Blue Beret, not even a U.S. I wasn't dual-hatted as I typically was, say, in Bosnia or Iraq or in Afghanistan. I was solely a United Nations officer, which was very instructive and a great learning experience as well. So again, seeking out those opportunities in particular to get out of your intellectual comfort zone, I found very important, and I still do that. And, you know, one of the reasons I do this kind of thing is that it causes you to reflect, to think, to solidify your thinking. And I'll give you, by the way, remind me to give you the link to we did a website. Well, I was a fellow at Harvard for 6 years after leaving government, you know, while at KKR, obviously, it was a very much a part-time thing. But it required of me with a great team there, most of whom had worked for me in Iraq or Afghanistan, who were grad students, to distill this leadership construct that I've described of the four tasks of a strategic leader, and then also to discuss the tactics, techniques, and procedures of leadership. And it was great fun, but it requires you, again, to think things through, to get the big ideas right about that kind of construct and how to describe it, capture it, distill it, communicate it, and so on. And again, that's really valuable. It's why I'm engaged with a number of think tanks now. It's why I do a variety of different activities. And again, it's why I love being the chairman of the KKR Global Institute, you know, to do geopolitical risk and then determine how to mitigate it for the world's, I think, second largest investment firm of our type. KKR is just a very intellectually stimulating endeavor and truly enjoyable. It also requires a lot of travel. Again, you got to force yourself to do that. It'd be a lot easier just to hang out at home and walk the dog and all that stuff. But I think you have to set goals for yourself. You have to actually announce them to others so they'll hold you accountable for them. And then you've got to actually carry through and do it what it is that you have committed to do. Again, noting that along the way, sometimes you're going to say, oh, man, you know, why did I commit to running 10 miles today instead of, I don't know, 4 or 6 or something? Why did I do the hill today when I could have stayed on the flat? Well, you know, it's, again, because you're pushing yourself and life is a competitive endeavor. And this is all part of preparing for the moment when you might be asked to do something of real consequence at a critical time, as I was privileged to do several times over the years. You know, again, the final thought perhaps is that luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity. And if that opportunity comes along, you want to have done everything you can to prepare yourself for it.
Sir, I couldn't think of a better way to finish. As people want to learn and connect and more about KKR and everything, we'll make sure we link in the show notes. Where can people go to find out more, sir, about you and everything that you're up to?
You know, I'm only on one social media. It's LinkedIn, you know, and I actually do a daily post on Ukraine. I distill with the Great Institute for the Study of War. I'm on their board. We have the Petraeus Center for Emerging Leaders there. I'm pretty active with them. And again, various other pieces that I think are worthy of folks looking at. But I mean, if they want to look at what I've done and all the rest of it, it's pretty clearly listed, the various organizations with which I've been privileged to work over the years and those that I'm active with now, which is a fairly substantial number. It's quite a juggling act to keep all these various plates spinning at the same time.
Sir, thank you for your strategies, your methods, your tactics, and most importantly, thanks for having our six. Really appreciate you coming on today.
Thanks, Tony. Great to be with you, and thanks for what you're doing in our great division, Aerosol.
Sixers, Bruce Lee said, I fear not the man who has practiced 10,000 kicks once, but I fear the man who has practiced one kick 10,000 times. I hear that and I think of the team over at Bridgebuilt. I own a Phoenix squat rack and it is the absolute ultimate piece of gym equipment that I have at the house. Heavy duty construction, versatile design, and the ability to fold up for limited space. Not to the wall, not to the floor, you just fold it up on wheels, move it wherever it needs to go. Head over to bridgebuilt.com and upgrade your gym today to the Phoenix squat rack. Hey Sixers, did you know the Got Your Six podcast is now streaming every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern and Saturdays at 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern on Wreaths Across America Radio, available on the iHeartRadio app, the Audacity app, and the TuneIn app. Just search the word Wreath. If you got something out of this, be a battle buddy. Share with a friend, pass it along. If you're listening on Apple or Spotify, make sure you leave us a review and give us as many stars as you think we warrant because we love what we do here at the Got Your Six podcast. We're always adapting and evolving this podcast because of you, the Sixers. And if you're listening on Spotify, hit that follow button. You'll never miss an episode when we drop new ones every Monday.
I don't know what you've been told, Sixers, but the lawyers would like us to remind you that the views, opinions, and comments expressed on the Got Your Six podcast are solely those of the hosts or guests, to include current and previous Department of Defense employees, and should in no way be considered the opinions of or endorsements on behalf of the Department of Defense or any of its components, divisions, contractors, or other current and previous staff members.